Vibrating on all frequencies from the jungle of death, you're listening to Babes in the Woods.
Hello, welcome back to the jungle of death. We're all here, your babes in the woods. I'm Lindsay, and I'm joined by my beautiful and talented co-hosts, Rachel.
Hello!
And Nyssa.
Hey, guys.
So, we're all hanging out today, having a very topical conversation about young adult heroines. How have you guys been? How are you feeling about heroines today?
I'm really excited right now, because I feel like this is... Yeah, this is something that's kind of been growing in popularity over the last, I'd say, 15 years or so.
Yeah.
I think we've definitely seen a recent explosion of heroines, yeah. So we've got a lot of, you know, recent developments to evaluate. But I know that I think we should probably kick it off by talking about a few of our favorites from childhood or young adulthood ourselves. I would say that for myself, my formative young adult heroine was probably Princess Cymmarine of the Enchanted Forest series by Patricia C. Reed. She's a rogue princess who shirks her duties to go and be the personal assistant / cook for a dragon. And I like it because it subverts a lot of, like, princess ideas and also a lot of evil dragons holding princesses hostage ideas. It's very clever in that way, super funny. And the first book in the series was published in 1990. So it came along in year 7 of Lindsay Cronk developmental pattern, which was really good. And I appreciated it for existing. What about you guys?
Well, for me, it's funny because reading, growing up, I know we talked about this the last podcast, I didn't read a lot of, like, genre. I was really into, like, Nancy Drew when I was younger. And then as I got older, I mean, to be honest, my biggest introduction into young adult fiction that was genre related that actually had big female characters was Harry Potter. So for me, it feels kind of like trite sometimes to say this because Hermione Granger now feels like she's permeated a certain amount of pop culture with Emma Watson and all that. But I love Hermione Granger. Like, she's a smart girl. She's kind of bossy. I love that she's a know-it-all even when she doesn't know it.
The bossiness factor is awesome. Looking back,
it's kind of like the flaws. I think we just talked about this, but the flaws that she has are ones that really I had as well.
That's a great thing about the Harry Potter, the later Harry Potter books especially. Like, you kind of hate the characters sometimes, but only because they're too real, you know?
Yeah.
Like, Heslock Harry political. Is obnoxious because he's 15.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it's like, she gets political, she gets very involved in social issues, and I really kind of related to that. For me, going from being very conservative to being liberal in a fairly short amount of time for myself, I really related to that kind of, like, awakening of her political aspirations. Mm. I thought that was really cool.
I really like about Hermione that she's become an archetype in the short time that she has existed as a character. Like, she is an archetype already.
Yeah.
You know, because people were looking for someone to fill that spot.
We're going to talk a little bit in this later about sort of the rise of the bookish young lady, I think, as the heroine for bookish young ladies. Like, the way we've seen this shift to address who's reading these books, I think, by putting them in that position. And I think that Hermione was really, she was a front runner of that. She sort of was the one who I think started to really bring things around in the mainstream.
Sort of breaking that ground. I've just thought of this right now, but Meg from Wrinkle in Time is kind of like that too.
Meg Murray, yes. Glasses.
Yeah.
Glasses, what are they called?
The Madeline L'Engle books.
Dreamboat eyes. You know. Calvin. Oh. Calvin was one of my first real crushes in books, I think. Meg Murray is a quintessential nerd lady who, you know, like, isn't necessarily your traditional heroine in the least, and she also shows that sort of self-deprecating, self-doubting side that I think most young women experience in teenage, which I think we see a lot of now in our young adult heroines. Like, they're very self-aware and very self-conscious, and that reflects, I think, their audience. So when I get annoyed with it, I have to remind myself that these books aren't written for, like, bossy, almost 30 women. They're written for young women struggling to find their own identities. When we're addressing this, I think that's important to keep in mind, is that my perspective isn't necessarily the perspective of the audiences. You know, we talked about that a little bit in Our Beautiful Creatures podcast. But I would say, you know, outside of genre for me, a big person too is Catherine called Birdie. Did you guys read that one?
Oh, yeah.
Set in the Middle Ages. Yeah. Like, she's like pranking all her medieval suitors because she doesn't think they're good enough, and it's great.
Right.
And that's an unexpected and good one. You know, and like Anne Shirley, you know, outside of genre, you see the rise of sort of this style of heroine, I think, because more and more publishers and writers realized that women were reading books, or maybe, you know, like, you could even say women were beginning to read books, just depending on how you want to, like, evaluate the history of education and literacy in the United States, particularly. So, sort of to move the conversation forward, let me consult my handy-dandy outline. Do you guys feel like, you know, this year we're having a lot of films released that are adaptations of young adult books. I've written down a few. So we've got the next Hunger Games film is coming out, Catching Fire, so Katniss Everdeen. We had Julie in Warm Bodies, who we've already addressed at some length, Lena in Beautiful Creatures. We have Triss, or Beatrice, previously in the Divergent series, Wanda, Mel, and The Host, which is another Stephanie Meyer book. And then we have Clary from the Mortal Instruments series. Now, I don't know how familiar you guys are with any of these books, but I will tell you, frankly, that I've read the Hunger Games series. I read the first Beautiful Creatures book and promptly forgot everything about it. I read a synopsis of Divergent on Wikipedia because I wanted to know about it. And I read The Host, actually, but I have not read the Mortal Instruments series. Have you, either of you guys read it?
I haven't.
I haven't because of being in the whole fan, the Harry Potter fan fiction circle when Cassandra Clare went, the girl who wrote those, she's had a lot of problems, and became very infamous very quickly. And the whole Mortal Instruments thing, first of all, the title that she uses for it is also the title of a Ron Ginny fic that she wrote.
Oh.
And that takes, you know, she takes whole chapters from her own stuff, and she's had huge plagiarism problems from other authors. I want to say, I can't remember if it's Patricia Reed or, I think so, because she's on LiveJournal and one other lady. But, like, just huge, huge segments of text. So, like, I didn't read them out of principle. I know that they're super popular, and I get the sort of overall idea. But, you know, in solidarity with my internet brethren and sisters, I haven't read. And I plan
so is it, can I ask you this? Is this a 50 Shades of Grey scenario? Like, is this a Harry Potter fanfic where a few things have been changed, but really it's just Harry Potter?
I don't think it's quite as direct as that, but I think most of her source material is, her just changing the names of characters from Harry Potter fic she wrote.
That is appalling. I think, you know, that we'll go out on a limb and say that we're not going to discuss that any further. But that's hilarious and amazing. But these are all huge budget studio adaptations. So I think that it's interesting to note that, you know, there's been the rise of young adult literature in recent years, and then the rise of course, tween media as a behemoth. And what we're seeing now is sort of a reflection of that. And all of these heroines, you know, with all of their flaws and all of their, you know, virtues, are sort of a reflection of their time, which is a really interesting time to be living in, where tween girls are really running things, it seems. So as, you know, three women in their late mid-20s, let's set out to address this a little bit more. But before we do so, let's take a break. And we're back. We're going to talk to you a little bit right now, I think, about sort of what we're seeing as the, we're going to describe it as the rise of the introvert, introverted young adult heroines, and sort of how they've come to take over sort of multiple facets of genre and become the sort of standard instead of the outlier.
Right. I think part of it is because it's easier to identify it with an introvert. Like, if you are an introvert, you're already in her shoes. And if you're an extrovert, like, it's easier to imagine being, like, you know, than the other way around. Like, it's one less step of removal for the reader from the character.
I feel like, too, there's this idea, I mean, I feel like most people who are extroverted have something of an introverted side. Everybody needs that, like, time to be by themselves. So I think everybody's a little antisocial at times. So I think everybody has that, I think you're right, like, you can always kind of relate to that aspect of it. I think also it's like, this is the first time, really, because the people who are reading books a lot of times are more introverted. The people who really gobble up books are more introverted.
Right.
So I think they're really playing up to. Books are my friend.
Also, yeah, when you're a teenage girl, I don't think that anyone's going to fight me on this one. I feel like it's maybe the most awkward point in your life. Mm-hmm. So even if you're not the world's most introverted person, it will make you incredibly self-conscious in such a way that you will feel as though, one, no one understands you, and two, you have this ongoing, like, inner monologue that's all about self-doubt. I mean, I feel like people that complained about Katniss Everdeen's inner monologue are people that had never lived with feeling self-conscious or wondering if you could trust people.
Right.
I feel like, you know, like, if you put her brain, her, like, way of talking, like, it wouldn't be so removed from my seventh grade journal. So, I mean,
right.
And I'm a big, confident extrovert at this point in my life most of the time.
To be fair, though, you're a lot smarter than Katniss.
Yes. Yes.
I love Katniss to death, she's done with
me prowling through the lockers and wondering if people were being straight with me in middle school was not so different from Katniss wandering, scrounging, and trying to survive the Hunger Games. And I feel like many young women identify with that, and maybe that has to do with the fact that nothing resembles the post-apocalypse so much in modern society as a middle school.
Well, it's kind of that whole idea of, we talk about Buffy, like, every single time. See, now I'm the one to bring it up.
Yes.
But Willow Rosenberg really is that character.
Yeah.
I mean, I know, obviously, she's a television character, and she's the only one we'll probably mention at this point, but that was another one, I think, that in talking about the rise of the introvert, I should say, I feel like, in a way, that kind of kicked off with Buffy and Willow, and or at least it all started to happen right around that time, and Willow being this very easily identified with character for most girls who were really the target audience for Buffy.
Yeah, right. And the thing about it is, like, when you look at the introverted sort of female leads that we see in these books, in many cases you can imagine them being friends. Like, I can imagine Hermione hanging out with Willow. I can imagine, you know.
That'd be the most adorable friendship.
I can imagine.
I don't know. I feel like they'd get into one argument and then hate each other forever.
It's totally possible, but
dueling witches.
Willow is one of the more forgiving characters in history, except for, you know, the season where she went dark. She, you know, put up with a bunch of crap from both Xander and Buffy. So,
that's true.
And even our beloved Giles. You know, like, our poor Willow took a lot of stuff. But yeah, so in terms of introverted heroines, are there any in particular that you two would like to touch upon?
I mean, I talked about Hermione, so obviously she's there. She's an introverted heroine that's coming, that, you know, rose up around this time, and as we were talking about, became kind of an archetype for the introverted heroine. There's actually one that was before that that's in the Giver Quartet, which is from Gathering Blue, and that's Kira.
Mm-hmm.
And she's an outcast due to her defect of her leg, and therefore a lot. And even her, like, power that she eventually kind of discovers is very much a solitary thing, because it's all about her weaving, you know, like a cloth and her ability to weave, and, like, it all ties into that. And so it's all very much kind of tied into this introverted activity and being an outcast. I think that's part of it too, is very much whether or not they're introverts, a lot of times they're always outcasts. I mean, that's even Katniss.
I think that Julie actually in this case is sort of an interesting counterpoint in Warm Bodies, because she seems to be very well adjusted, has a best friend and a boyfriend. We don't see signs of that much self-consciousness on her part. So she's an interesting one to sort
of, she's certainly not an outcast.
No.
Like, she's part of group. Like.
But she's an interesting one to lay aside in this conversation, because then Lena from Beautiful Creatures is such an outcast, such an archetypal, like, weird kid, introverted heroine, loving poetry, writing it on her ceiling. It's sort of annoying to us.
Terrible gothy clothes.
Yes, and we talked about this a little last time. I know that The Host is coming out soon, though I'm not a Stephenie Meyer fan. I do think that the Wanda Mel character also fits into this. She has low self-esteem. She's on the run. She's outcast. Well, you have the alien that's taken over her. She's a weirdo because she travels from planet to planet. Most of her alien species chooses one body and stays in it, but she's what's called a traveler. And so she's trying to soak up a whole variety of experiences and basically occupies different forms.
I like that they're both special snowflakes coming together to form a completely forgettable narrative.
Yes. But I think that this one's interesting because, whereas Twilight, you know, I think that what's interesting about Stephenie Meyer, and I'm going to say this, and this is not in defense of Stephenie Meyer, but she does do interesting things with standard fare. So aliens, she tells us the story. She tells us the story of an alien occupation through the eyes of the occupying force. With Twilight, her the coolest thing about her vampires is that they were hard as rocks, and that the only way to kill them was to rip off their heads and tear all of their limbs from their torsos, then set them on fire. Like, curiously violent stuff. Like, the details of Stephenie Meyer are always the best part. And if you just heard that part, you'd be like, what? I want to read about this weird, you know, vampire thing. Instead of,
no, you don't.
Bella loves Romeo and Juliet. The faux bookishness. Okay, so this is something that I think comes back around to the introverted heroine, though, is when a bad author writes about someone who's supposed to be a bookish introvert and then fails to convey that, you get a Bella Swan, and they're just, they're wolves in bookish heroine's clothing. They're just horrible. I just can't even deal with it. It's just so fake. It's like those stupid fake nerd glasses. Bella Swan is Dwayne Wade's glasses.
Oh, no.
I think it's funny because the introverted heroine really goes back around, I think, to Jane Austen and that idea of that kind of turn-of-the-century romantic novel.
Mm-hmm.
Turn-of-the-century, is that about right?
Centuries ago.
Napoleonic.
Like, we're talking 1812-ish.
I live in the 1900s. I was born there. Sure. I think that it really does...
Well, I'm not sure, though, that we can describe either of her most famous heroines as introverted in any way at all. Like,
okay.
Neither Emma nor Lizzie Bennet.
No,
but I think that...
But the Woodhouses...
I think the girls who read them, in general...
That's true.
Eleanor, you have... Even Emma, to a certain extent, a lot of it is... Women who, even if they're extroverted, they have these very introverted lives because they are alienated in terms of they don't have the powers that men
have.
They're automatically secluded.
Well, that's true. The default, well, the necessary, I guess.
Yeah, there's an automatic feeling of other about them, I think, within their own society. And therefore, I think that a lot of it harkens back. And also, I think it has to do with the fact that, again, the target audience in general is very familiar with... like Pride and Prejudice and Sense and Sensibility and Emma. Most girls I know who have read, that's the thing that's always been shocking to me, is that a lot of the young girls I've met who love Twilight also love Jane Austen, and they love books that I loved. It's why it was so disturbing when it became such a huge thing for me.
Here's the
thing
about
it, though.
Yeah, they
also like Wuthering Heights.
In the hyper-powerful Cullen universe, Bella is powerless in a way that is similar to women of Jane Austen's time. Like, she's put herself in that position on purpose. Like, to be overpowered by this guy who insists on, and I'm using finger quotation marks, listeners, protecting her from life. whereas I think the interesting part of many of these other heroines, I mean, Hermione Granger aside, is we're looking, and Lena, who's in a small town, we're looking at a lot of post-apocalyptic scenarios. And in those post-apocalyptic scenarios, we see women empowered because there are just, I think, fewer people.
Yeah. I mean, you see
that's entirely possible, yeah.
I mean, we were talking, there's always the Uglies, which is a series that I really enjoyed, actually, and... I mean, when you're discussing heroines making stupid choices, Tally definitely makes a lot of stupid choices. But it's interesting because a lot of it is driven by this self-conscious need to become a pretty, and not only becoming a pretty in terms of looks, but it's this idea of what you're supposed to become, this place you're supposed to take in society, and the idea that you are, it's essentially about graduating into your 20s and going to college and partying all the time. I mean, that's really what being a pretty is.
Yeah, it's a very standard, like, they use the phrase growing up a lot in this book. And, you know, it's really, and the way they talk about, you know, the uglies are running around with all their hormones raging and everything, but, like, you know, because they're young. And it's nothing counts when you're young because you have to grow up afterwards. And, you know, in this case, growing up is, you know, becoming a celebutante, basically, until you become middle-aged and have to get a job. But
yeah, that's exactly
you get another operation to be slightly less attractive, and you get a job. But,
wow, that's crazy. I need to pick up those books.
It's also
another one to be old.
The other thing that's kind of interesting, and this is more going into the Giver series, which not so much with the young adult heroines, but there is this idea in post-apocalyptic scenarios, and this ties in, I think, to Twilight as well. In Twilight, it glorifies it. In all the other young adult books, I think that it demonizes this, but this suppression of hormones and this suppression of really natural urges for sex.
Yeah.
I mean, in the Uglies, that's something that happens when you're pretty. Is like you kind of, it's supposedly that you become more adult, and so you're
right, like you chill out in some way.
Yeah, and it's weird because like people definitely start having relationships more, so it's the idea that you're having them, but you're being responsible because you don't have these overwhelming urges.
Right.
You don't
think about being a new pretty is responsible.
Well, yeah, and it's so much of it is about ignoring the natural urges that occur to you.
Right. Overriding nature, like controlling biology. They talk about biology all the time. And how, like, you have to be pretty because you're conditioned to think these things are pretty. And, you know, anything else is just jarring. But then it's really control. And, I mean, not for the individual, obviously, but for the tiny
as a societal
people running, you know.
Actually, similarly, in Stephanie Meyer's The Host, the aliens arrive. And part of their rationale for taking over species after species is that the species don't know how to do it right, and they do. And so they basically pacify the population by inserting these symbiotic worm creatures. And there are, like,
gross.
It reminds
this
me
would be
actually
a lot better if they were all called gold and just, like, show up in the star meeting.
Do either of you watch, did you watch Star Trek Deep Space Nine or, anyway, there's this race of aliens called the Trill, and the Trill are symbiotic. Like they're symbiotic. Like there are these like basically the people are like unfilled hot pockets, and everyone's competing for the worm filling that then gives them different lifetimes of experience. And so one of the best characters in all of Star Trek is Dax, and Dax is this sort of scrappy female scientist who has lived no fewer than 9 lives as a man and a woman, and is sort of a scamp. The problem, I would argue, with Stephanie Meyer's The Host is the worm creatures aren't cool. They remind me of your pretties. They lack emotion, and they're just like, this is fun, like, all the time. They're, like, strong sad. And of course, the moral of the story in The Host is that she, our main traveler alien, Mel, comes to realize the virtues of human emotion and joins the human resistance. By, this is the creepiest part, right? Like, because it's Stephanie Meyer, so there has to be an imprinting twist, right?
Oh,
you ready for this?
Heaven.
So there's a mentally disabled young woman who she ultimately winds up taking over that body so that she's not occupying a body that has, like, a real brain.
Are you serious?
I am 100% serious. Oh, guys.
That's the worst thing.
Listeners, I wish you could see the look on the faces of my co-hosts, because it is.
Oh, my God, that's awful.
Dude, it's Stephanie Meyer. She's terrifying. I think she's a psychopath. Like, the more I read her stuff, the more I'm just like, this is fucking crazy.
Mental challenges is not a person.
Not a person.
So that's cool.
No. I mean, honestly, in that case, the worm creature was healing her.
Oh, my God. That's terrifying.
Yeah.
That's the worst thing in the world.
That anyone could think that that was true and that there's no, again, I cannot wait to see how they... Her lack of agency for anyone, anybody, especially any female characters, and I mean, that's the host... the reason why I hadn't read it was, and that I thought I would get pretty angry reading it, is that Stephanie Meyer and her taking away of agency from people so frequently. Yeah.
Well, she
really
takes away everyone's agency
off.
In this book.
Well, she
loves
for no one to have any idea what they're doing. Right?
Anyway, I found it's a fascinating study, just because I do feel like Stephanie Meyer sometimes has wholly original thoughts, but they're just the most terrifying, psychotic things. that I've ever seen. They're just like the ranty. She belongs in Arkham Asylum. I just don't know. She's a fucking supervillain.
Oh, that'd be amazing.
Just, it's so it's good. Like it's like the Joker, Two Face, Stephanie Meyer. Stephanie Meyer. Dying of fire. So that's my host rant, which I was waiting for the whole episode.
Wow.
Yes.
Wow.
I mean. So
what were we even talking about before?
We were talking about the pretties and like the element of control that exists in post-apocalyptic societies, which
this
our female protagonists are often acting in opposition of.
I just finished the first Divergent book, but it's actually called Divergent. And they have a similar, like, the reason for dividing into the factions is about controlling human response and avoiding another, you know, meltdown apocalypse, whatever actually happened, because they never really discussed that. But, you know, the idea that you can choose what you think is responsible for having destroyed human society and then actively work to avoid that, you know, is, again, about trying to control human nature.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that's... I mean, it's done differently, obviously, and there's no...
Oh, yeah.
Implication that, you know, differently abled people are not real.
Yeah. So. Well, I think it's interesting because I think the opposite is true. And again, you can always point to Stephanie Meyer to be, because I think most young adult novels actually do aspire to raise up their young adult heroines, like those heroines that are younger that become these great role models. Even with Katniss, like she doesn't aspire for more, perhaps.
Right.
But she aspires for a choice. She aspires to have an opportunity to choose what becomes of her life. And so I think choice becomes a very, even with the uglies, like when, spoiler alert, when Tally becomes, I don't want to say anything actually, you're still finishing it. Hold on, never
mind. I've only got 20 pages left, it's
all
right.
Dude, that's the roughest of all possible things. Do not spoil it for her.
I don't want to spoil it for you, but let's just say that everything that she does, I feel like, becomes a very specific choice for her. It's not something that's forced on her, which is really interesting, I think.
That is, and I like about Katniss that, I mean, the one thing that she always has going for her is, you know, as selfish as she thinks she is a lot of the time, she's never doing it for her.
Yeah.
Like, she knows that the Hunger Games is her death sentence going in, so she's doing it so that other people don't have to. I mean, specifically Prim, but, you know.
Yes, because this is the thing I think about, actually, in all of these scenarios. And the Bechdel test was actually designed for movies, but I like to apply it in these books as well, you know, are there at least two female characters that are named in these books?
Yeah.
And do they talk about something to each other that's not about a man?
Yeah,
and in the case of Stephanie Meyer's books, no, never. It's never the case.
True.
They just... Anytime Bella is talking to Alice, she's talking about Edward. Anytime Mel is talking to anyone, it's about one or the other of the boys in the love triangle that she's involved in. Katniss, though, has lots of conversations with Prim and her mother that are just all about survival, good parenting, and being part of a good family unit. And I think that's part of the reason she's such an admirable character. And honestly, I'd be less inclined to tolerate her sort of blunt-edged stupidity. Like, there's, like, a blunt instrument quality to Katniss that can be kind of grinding, right? Like, I'm not alone in
this,
right?
She's always the dumbest person in a room. And sometimes you're just like, seriously, wake up.
She's just
unaware of
things.
She doesn't understand subtext at all.
which I think is part of the reason it's so good. And I initially objected to the casting of, what's her face?
Jennifer Lawrence.
Jennifer Lawrence in that role, but she's just phenomenal in it because
she's done such a good job. I love her to death.
She has such a depth and an ability to portray that character authentically that it's overcome the fact that, you know, from an outside perspective.
It helps that she was basically the same character only in with more Bone. Dimension in Winter's Bone.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But she was phenomenal in that too.
Oh my god. Yeah. Winter's Bone is so badass. And it's practically a fantasy movie too.
Yeah.
There's also something I think to be said, even when you talk about books that have a romantic edge to them. I think this is true in Hunger Games. I think this is true in the Ugly series and even true in Harry Potter, that a lot of times the romance is about someone growing up. There's an element to, in the Uglies, there's kind of a couple of different romances depending on who you're talking about, but the girls talk mostly about their bodies and like what society is, and it feels like a very real conversation. And through, it's more like with their relationships with men is about self-discovery, which I think is much more realistic in terms of how relationships really do help you grow. So I kind of like that even when there is a romance in a lot of these novels, in many of these novels, perhaps not in a lot, but in many of them, there's this sense that the romance isn't the end point. It's part of the journey.
I definitely felt that way about Divergent, because there is a romantic interest. Mm-hmm. Or Triss, obviously, because it wouldn't be turned into a movie if there weren't, right? But
at this point, I don't know if it would be published without one, right?
Like, it's very hard to get published without one. It has to be a much younger character, I think, otherwise.
Like, your Lyra doesn't have a, in His Dark Materials, Lyra Belacqua, she has a, her pursuit of her best friend, right, that drives the first book.
Right.
But there's no, like, she's like 10. So you don't have to have her.
Deba Resham is similarly quite young, and she has a sort of semi-suggested romantic interest, but it's never, ever pursued in any sort of way, like, strongly. But what was I going to say about Divergent? Oh, that I'm thinking about the Bechdel test for this, and there are two other named female characters in her group, I think, and one of them is a bad guy, and the other one, they definitely have a bunch of conversations, but I cannot now remember how many of them are not about her interest in the guy.
If I go through the list,
I'm sure there's at least one.
You know, Harry Potter, there are lots of named female characters, though we do have our heroic trio at the center of it. And I know Hermione has conversations with them that aren't about boys, but when Ginny Weasley comes in, it sort of becomes a Bechdel test fail, right, at that point, because you know that basically all their conversations are about man-pining. And that's
one of my problems. The sixth book is the worst thing ever.
It's my key problem with Ginny Weasley, who I know is, like, a favorite all over the internet, so I'm prepared to get internet punched for saying that. So Bella, no, all of her conversations, again, as we've discussed, are about dudes. Katniss wins the Bechdel test, hands down.
Yeah.
Julie in Warm Bodies, I think that we can count that one dream discussion where she's hanging out with her friend. And they're all talking about the future.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But we can count that.
Every other conversation she has with her adorable friend who I love, is about a boy.
Yeah.
Lena, 100% fail, right, dudes? Like, I mean, like,
yeah,
she doesn't even have another lady to talk to, really.
No.
The lady show up to taunt her about the fact that they just killed her boyfriend in order to, like, you know, like, bring her to the dark side. Like, that is 100% of their conversations. Poor Emma Thompson just wasted forever and makes me sad. And then, you know, you just discussed Triss. Wanda Mellon, the host, total Bechdel fail. I can't think of any other girls in that. Though they are in each other's heads, and really they're yelling about a bunch of stuff, but mainly it's, hey, bitch, get out of my body! and then, you know, that's my whole story.
Diva passes the test.
Good.
Oh, does it?
Good.
On London, they start out with two heroines, Diva and Vanna, both go to London, sort of accidentally. And so they talk about a lot of things. A great deal of which, for some time, is how the hell do we get home? What are we doing here? But, you know, everything they talk... And because there's not really any romantic involvement on either part, they never get the chance to talk about a boy. So, you know, they pass by default. But, you know.
But here's another question, though, I think in many of these cases. And I don't know. There must be, like, a term for it. Like, a film term. or, you know, a literary critical term.
I don't think Sabriel passes.
I don't think it does.
I love Sabriel to death, but yeah. I don't think she ever gets another girl to talk to.
Nope. And that's the thing is, if we're writing books for girls, shouldn't they have other more than one? Like yeah. a community of women? But
Liriel does, if you count the disreputable dog, because she's female.
Yeah. Cimmerine is hanging out with an ancient female dragon all the time in the Enchanted yeah, that's Forest. True. So even though it's an anthropomorphic girl, we're going to give it to her. Yeah. And she has another, like, princess that's also, like, serving as a captive cook to another dragon. But I would say that in all of these cases, we're encountering our main protagonists are white. And yeah. we're not seeing a lot of racial diversity in this. It could be reflecting the traditional white privilege of genre. Yeah. But, you know, like, the thing is, I think of, and this is a ridiculous thing to say, but I think of, like, Wu-Tang Clan and stuff, and how much, like, rappers and hip-hop culture are into things like sci-fi and nerd culture, particularly in recent years, how much it's been sort of engaged. And I just wonder at the fact that it hasn't, we haven't seen an outbreak of, like, that integration. You know, like, I would love to see, you know, young black strong protagonists for everyone's sake, but also
well, there was
for
that whole
sake
thing
of black
where they
girls.
Were, you know, threatening to hire Donald Glover as Spider-Man, and that would have been amazing.
I love Donald Glover so much.
He's perfect for that role too, which is what's so sad about it is that
unless
he's,
they cast
him
in bed, which I would also be.
Like, oh, ha, ha, it's a joke. Like, no, but we wanted that.
But we actually wanted that. And remember how the internet exploded with people who like hated the idea too?
Oh yeah. Well, just like people were upset when the Hunger Games movie came out when explicitly black characters were portrayed by black actors.
Well, isn't it?
Oh yeah.
But didn't we see in the Isn't it right that the tributes that we see for the Quarter Quell, like, wasn't, like, one black guy turned into a white guy? Now, I feel like...
No, they're both black.
Okay, good.
Oh, for
the second
that?
Movie?
Yeah.
In the second movie or
the
first
second
movie?
I think they made...
Oh, I haven't seen the
I think
second
they
movie.
Made
the only person I remember specifically being black in the second book is Inubaria.
I think they made someone black, a really white-skinned lady.
And, like, she's supposed to be this terrifying, super dark woman with, like, filed sharp teeth and, like, just basically look like a nightmare. And she's so cool.
Yeah. Yeah.
But, like, I think they just picked some little pretty girl. I don't know. I don't remember who they cast because I was looking at it a long time ago.
It's one of those things, too, where I think that it's weird because Hunger Games... the internet's reaction, again, it's the internet, so take it with a grain of salt, but the internet's reaction was, why are these characters black, as opposed to, why are there not more characters who are black? Kind of like one of those things where...
Why are they black? God, Karen, you can't just ask people why they're black.
It's that whole idea, too, of what... It's almost like the studio, or maybe the person who's just casting, was so afraid to... cast something outside of the books as well, because there are a lot of those districts where it's kind of ambiguous whether or not they're black, white, Asian, Hispanic, Middle Eastern. We don't see any difference other than those two characters. And it's weird because even when there is diversity, I think in a lot of novels, it's more about black and white. There's also no, you don't see a lot of Asian characters, or if you
do. There's no other ethnicities.
Yeah. Yes. If you do though, they generally tend to be fetishized.
Yeah, there's a lot of Orientalism where if you get an Asian character, she's inevitably a Cho Chang, right?
Yeah.
Right? Oh, it's like, it reminds me of nothing so much as when My Little Ponies released their kimono, and she was quiet, she liked books, and she played the violin.
Yeah.
Like, right? That was, like, let's talk about how our perceptions of model minorities are also damaging. Like, you know, because then we say, like, oh, but these are the good ones. So that's one of the things that I definitely think that historically we've seen a lot of whitewashing in fantasy and sci-fi.
Absolutely.
But I don't understand.
Like, I can't even think, I feel like I should be able to think of, you know, protagonists of color, you know, even across gender lines. But really, I think I was saying this earlier, but I always assumed reading Unlondon that Diba was black just because the only physical description of her is... in sort of opposition to Xana, who is tall, striking, and blonde. He describes her as being shorter, darker, and rounder than Xana. But that's all we get.
Yeah.
And so I just assumed she was black.
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting in the Ugly series because they kind of address it, but then it's really all the characters, all the main characters are white, but it's partly because the society, the main society that we start with, has genetically speaking, they have changed everyone so that they are all one color because they've decided that wars were started because of differences between people. And right. So they've made everyone one color. And when you go through the operation to become a pretty, you generally, if you're a girl, you're going to have, even if you have like dark hair, you're going to have pale skin. You're going to have like colored eyes of some right. kind. And it's when they go to the smoke, which is this kind of alternate community that is in a, not really active rebellion, but trying to get away from that pretty society. Everyone is, you see people of different skin tones, of different heights, of different body shapes. So it's interesting in that they the authors address that in terms yeah. of, or he addresses that in terms of why everybody's white, and yet, but it's also in those things where it's kind of like, but everyone's still white.
Yeah.
Right?
Like,
yeah. They're still white, dude.
I really like, actually.
You could have gone the South Park route where everybody turns out to be this weird beige shade because there's been, you know, enough melding of genetics over time.
Yeah.
I like in The Hunger Games, actually, the way that, you know, like, we find out, you figure out using context clues, for instance, that Katniss is from an area of the country that we'd probably think is, like, Appalachia, right?
Right.
Like, and then, you know, you figure that, what's her name? Adorable,
Rue.
Tiny black girl,
Rue.
Yes, Rue. Rue is from the poor black South, right? Like, you figure these things out, and you put it
together.
It's
agricultural, though, so I sort of assumed it encompassed the whole Midwest, because it's supposed to be a really big district.
Yeah, but I kind of assumed that it was, because of the way they play up, it reminded me of nothing so much historically as, like, the fact that initially poor white sharecroppers and poor black people, like, were, like, binding together before sort of the political structure put racism in place and taught them to, you know, taught white people to believe that they were superior. Like, the ways
right.
in which, you know, I thought that it was a really interesting piece on, what's-her-face? Who wrote those?
Oh, Suzanne Collins.
Oh,
Suzanne
yeah.
Collins, I thought, did a really interesting job with that. Though, again, you can make the argument, and I would make the argument, that one black character, two black characters, from a
yeah.
single district does not diversity make.
No. I mean, there is something to be Finna's said.
Black.
Well, you know, Maria comes from District 2, I think.
Does he?
Yeah,
okay.
And Finn, isn't Finn supposedly a more of an olive-skinned? You get the feeling he's supposed to not be.
Well, okay, but Katniss describes her own skin as olive also.
Yes.
That's
olive
the thing.
Olive skin,
that,
black hair, and gray eyes.
I always assumed that to a certain extent with Katniss that she was actually a more, maybe almost like a Native American type. I don't know. I was trying to think of, like, I don't picture
her as
white. I
just figure that when people say olive skin, they mean tan.
Oh, I always picture something meaning more of like a Middle Eastern.
I always picture Mediterranean.
Yeah.
You guys
well, that's the thing,
think about how we're reading books, because I'm fascinated by this now. But I would say, like, what I find fascinating, actually,
I didn't think Finnick was ethnic.
I thought Finnick was
no.
totally ethnic.
I don't know, because his green eyes and brown hair, like,
yeah,
I pictured sort of chestnut hair, sort of unbleached. I figured he was just tan.
Something babelicious and interracial.
I always pictured him being kind of interracial. Let me look this up, actually. You guys keep talking. I'm going to look this up on
Wikipedia.
Oh my
god, he looks like Prince Naveen. That'd be amazing.
So for instance, in Firefly, where we have, you guys, I'm so bad at names today. What's her name?
Zoe?
Warrior Woman, yes.
Yeah, Zoe.
So, like, we've gotten to the point where we expect a, like, second-in-command character to be,
mm-hmm.
like, we expect some ethnic diversity, right? It's just that
mm-hmm.
I'm astounded that we haven't gotten to the point where we've seen a major production with a, I hesitate to say minority, but just something more diverse than a white person in charge.
Right.
Yeah.
Like,
and movies where Morgan Freeman is in charge don't count.
I was thinking about it, though. I do know Octavia Butler wrote a bunch
uh-huh.
of books with...
Oh, yeah, I read one of her books.
Like, they feature a lot of black protagonists,
yeah.
but on the other hand, she was black.
Yeah.
And I wonder how much of it has to do with white writers being afraid of writing black people.
I mean, that's
I think, honestly, that white writers should be more afraid of writing black people, because I feel like when they do a bad job.
I feel like that too, historically, but on the other hand, they've never, like, attempted to do it in a way that feels in any way authentic. There's a lot of dialecting and a lot of folk wisdoming and a lot of,
it's kind of like
magical negroing.
Let me emphasize this in a way I would never do for a white character.
Yes.
What is the name of that, Cry the Beloved Country?
Yeah.
In terms of that aspect of where he very much wrote about, and I mean, there's a lot of debate on how much of that was true, because I actually think he did, I never having lived in during the apartheid
in Africa,
have no idea what that experience is like, but I feel like he did a fairly good job of portraying discrimination in general.
Yeah.
But whether or not that's the experience of somebody who actually lived there is the thing that's really up
right,
for.
Right, it's difficult.
Yeah.
Although you could look at, you know, the comparative experiences explored in Cry the Beloved Country and District 9.
Yeah.
You know, which is actually a South African production and, you know, pretty obviously refers to apartheid, even if that's not, you know.
District 9 is so good. It's like the best
movie. Again, isn't he white? Isn't he telling that story from a white perspective? Yeah.
But then he becomes, like, you know, like, he becomes infected and becomes the other. Like, he has the experience.
And he's also, like, the filmmaker has also lived, you know, post-apartheid. So I think he has a better perspective on it than, you know, I can't remember who wrote Cry the Beloved Country.
Alan Patton. Something. I can't remember his last name.
There
yes,
you go.
Alan Patton.
That guy. I mean, that's true. It would be important to look for media from the other side, but I can't think of any.
No,
honestly.
And that's, I mean,
I'm sure that's not because it doesn't exist.
Yeah.
Why can't I find, I'm trying to find a really good description of, oh, here it goes, physical appearance.
We're on the Hunger Hunger Games wiki, you guys.
That's exactly what I'm on right now. He's tall, muscular, and athletic. They say with tan skin, bronze-colored hair, and sea-green eyes.
Boom. When white people say olive skin, they mean tan.
Yeah, maybe that's what. Maybe that's the thing to look at. I always assume that it's an ethnicity, Mediterranean or Middle Eastern.
I totally agree.
That's the thing, because olive skin can describe an Asian person. It can describe anybody who's not
white.
But
you guys
want to
know what I honestly just realized? When I hear olive skin, I think olive trees. I think olives and things. I think...
Hummus. See, I don't like olives, so I don't think of olives.
I hate olives, too, dude. They're the worst. You have to work so hard to make those things edible, and then they still aren't. It's just dumb. It's a dumb waste of energy, humanity.
It is. They're awful.
Olive oil is worthwhile.
So saith Lindsay Crump.
And with that, I think we will close this segment, having, I think, thoroughly discussed certain trends, if you will, in young adult heroines. When we return, let's talk about what we'd like to see. And we're back for a quick final segment to chat with you about what we'd like to see in the next generation of young adult heroines. And I think judging from the previous topic of conversation, one of the things that we all agree on is diversity.
Yeah. And not in the, like, Captain Planet, you know, kind of way.
Or the Power Rangers, where it's the Yellow Ranger, Asian Ranger.
Yeah, we want to see real diversity. That's a nuanced portrayal that makes them human beings instead of, you know, a slate of characteristics that we assign to nationalities as we see fit.
That'd be so
absolutely.
Go ahead.
We've got a lot of stuff we want to see clearly.
I think one of the things that I would like to see more of, actually, and I know we were talking about, you know, the introverted and bookish heroines, but I found Katniss so refreshing because she was always the dumbest person in the room.
Yes.
And I've gone back to, you know, like, I just read Divergent and Uglies, and I got frustrated being told all the time how smart these teenagers are, and I'm like, I liked how dumb she was.
I liked
you know, I miss that. I miss her, you know, knowing that other people know more than she does, and you know, being interested in finding out. how to be better.
Her willingness to contribute as part of a team, I think, is also sort of unique.
She was a hard worker.
Yeah. In the second book, we see her work really well with a group of sort of lovable misfits, is how I would describe that team within the and she's not always so determined to be the leader that, you know, she's not willing to listen to other people, and I think that's
She doesn't care about being the leader. She cares about surviving.
And the thing is that's interesting about books that you can't quite pull off, I think, in movies, is that Katniss doesn't have to be the leader in order for her to be the narrator and the main point of the book. Like, you know, and that's part of what makes her so interesting as a character. I agree with you, Nissa. I think it was exciting to see a woman of action rather than just someone who's constantly in their own heads thinking about the things they know. Sometimes what's frustrating about these heroines is that they know better and they don't speak up.
Removes so much agency a lot of the time, and you're just standing there letting the world happen to you. And that's definitely something Katniss never does.
And
like, she sits around debating sometimes, but usually it's while she's waiting for something else to finish happening so she can keep moving.
Perhaps she's been stung by killer bees and is recovering.
Right? She has to lay in a hole for 3 days.
Yes. And then we're like, yes, take this time to think, Katniss.
Like, that's okay. You can do that.
But I agree. I'd like to see a little bit more action. I'd like to see a little bit more physical force. I'd like to, because especially since one of my favorite movies of, I think, 2010 was the Gina Carano Haywire film. She's the MMA fighter that was put in that.
Yeah. I heard about that.
What was interesting about it was she fought like a girl. She used her legs a bunch, like lots of kicking, you know, like instead of like the upper body fighting that we've seen in traditional male fighting. She like definitely played to her strength. There was a scene in which she beat up Channing Tatum, and I 100% believed it. Like, why not show women that they can be physically strong and mentally strong and, you know, be in that sort of situation? It's one of the things I like.
That feeds into one other characteristic I'd like to see explored sometimes. Mm-hmm. Like, in all of these books that I've read recently, there's so much emphasis on how small these women are.
Yes.
They're always small and light. And it's not necessarily, you know, to be pretty. Like, Katniss is not, like, she's dangerously thin and she's just slight because
she's
of malnutrition.
She's wiry.
Yeah.
Right? She's super small. But they're always small. Mm. It's like, you know what? Not everybody can be. And you don't just get to be a lead character if you're little. I'm 5'8", and I will never be, you know,
well,
scrawny.
Well, how about this, too? Like, we live in a... I'm not, like, you know, like, I definitely think that everyone should be healthy, but we should all, like, be embracing, like, in literature as well, like, different kinds and styles of beauty and different, like, styles of body types and different, the functions of those. Like, we should all be trying to be more accepting, and we should break out of a certain predisposed flimsy girl mold that's been used for these girls, you know, like, and, you know, like, they're always shooting arrows. And not to, like, say that, like, archery is, like, the girly weapon or whatever, but it has been traditionally. I want to see a girl swinging a mace. I want to see a warrior princess. I think we froze.
Seeing it, and instead of it being all about them telling us how smart the character is, show us how smart the character
is.
Because the thing about...
To solve.
Yeah, it's kind of like the thing with Coraline is that she figures it out, not in the movie, which I do not like the movie, but the book version of her, she immediately figures out, this is a weird situation. I don't want to be here. Like, even though she's been angry at her parents, she immediately catches on and is like, this seems strange to me, in that way that I think actually children do have a good sense of what is right and what is wrong. Like, they have that sense of unease. I'd love to see more things of that, in that, you know, people who go with their instincts, kind of the way Katniss is, but who could also be bookish smart, even if they are themselves not bookish. Like, they're not introverted, but they are extroverted. They like to talk. They like to be around people, but they're also intelligent.
Like, archetypes definitely have a place. I mean, we've just spent all this time talking about various archetypes, but, like, it would be nice to branch out from them some,
I feel like
small, introverted, bookish girls is great, but why not have...
We've had a few of them now. We could try something different.
Right? Like, why not have taller, you know, action-y girls who do things and may not read so many books?
How about this, too? How about we have charismatic liars?
Rogues. Yeah.
There you go.
You
know,
like,
I feel like it's so much more acceptable for male characters than for female characters, and I'm tired of that. Like, I'd love to see a charmer. I'd love to see a, you know, like, a girl that's out, I don't want to use the phrase slutting it up, but I'm about to use the phrase slutting it up.
Yeah, no, I was going to say, that's at the top of my wish list is someone who's more comfortable with their sexuality, whether it be, let's be honest, I'd love to see some lesbian and gay main characters in fantasy in general, but specifically women, because I think lesbianism is a reality that is left out of so much young adult fiction. Right.
Introduced, it's always so fetishized through, like, the male gaze, you know, not authentic in any way.
Yes, I agree.
I think it would be nice to see kind of those, like, in a weird way, it would be nice to see a kind of Judy Blume-esque sci-fi novel or a fantasy novel. Oh, my God,
I want
to
read that book. That'd be so great.
Judy Blume in space.
Forever in space.
Let's do it.
It's on.
I mean, even also seeing something along the lines of, Orson Scott Card being an asshole. Ha ha ha. I'm now going to talk about Orson Scott Card and gay characters in the same breath.
Oh my gosh. We totally forgot to talk about Petra at all. And she's such
an archetype. Right. Yeah.
You know, she's strong and tall.
I'm sure we'll have an Ender's Game show for when the movie comes out.
I'll have to reread it by then.
Oh, it's so good.
But I would love to see a kind of Ender's Game, that idea, and granted, Petra is like this, but that kind of warrior woman being the main character as opposed to being a side character.
Yeah.
Well, they turn her, even Petra's strengths, one of my beefs with Orson Scott Card is he has, like, all these throwaway lines because we are presented Valentine as main character, and Valentine is sort of more your traditional introverted, like, heroine who's, like, using her brains to manipulate things. And then Petra's introduced, and she's sort of, she's totally the outlier in Battle School, and everyone looks at her like she's the freak, because she's the only girl there, because she's the only one with enough power and the will to power to want it, and everyone's just like, oh, but she's, you know, like, she's not as good at it as us, because we're men.
Right.
Yeah.
And it's frustrating. It's really frustrating, because you hear Orson Scott Card's voice saying these things.
Yeah.
It's also this idea of, I think we've mentioned this in our horror episode, but the Descendants and, not the Descendants, the Descent.
I'm like, I didn't see that movie, I don't.
The Descent, and this idea of, like, women in those situations together would, I think, be really refreshing as well.
I completely agree.
Not necessarily having to have male characters constantly around them would be really interesting.
Have you guys read Why the Last Man at All?
Descending into cattiness like they do for about half of the Descent.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true.
There's this really awesome comic called Why the Last Man, in which a virus wipes out all but one man. But the whole comic is told from the perspective of the one man. And so I think, like, sometimes I wish that, like, authors would realize the obvious flip and give us, like, let's have the view of all women who are suddenly running society. You know, there's this really ridiculous cult of Amazons that are all slicing off their left breast, and, like, that's about the extent of it that you get. I'd love to see an all-female cast doing something. It's one of the things I'm actually excited about this new Gail Carriger book, which I think is called, like, Charm Academy or something like that, but it's basically a school of espionage for
girls.
Oh, yeah, finishing
school, I think.
Yeah. I'm stoked
about that. Can't remember if it was you or somebody else showed me a summary of it, and, like, I liked that the line was, like, at finishing school, you learn to finish everything.
Yeah.
Like, including killing people. And it's amazing.
It's totally cool.
Finish him.
Oh my god, it's also Mortal Kombat.
Speaking of finishing, though, you guys, how would you feel about finishing up with an MFK?
I think that'd be great.
I feel like we should do an MFK. I think we should do an MFK of unlikable female characters, because the likable, and then we'll do likable ones. I promise.
Okay.
So, all
right.
MFK. Let's go, Bella from Twilight. Yes. Let's do Lena from Beautiful Creatures.
Oh my god.
And I guess we're gonna do Cho Chang.
Why do you hate...
No, Ginny. Ginny Weasley. I will give you Ginny Weasley.
No, I still want to set them all on fire.
I'm going to marry Ginny Weasley because I like Weasleys.
That's true. Then you get to be part of the Weasley
family. Wait. I changed my mind. I'm going to murder Ginny Weasley because I don't want to be Mrs. Weasley's daughter-in-law.
Oh, that's fair, actually.
It sounds kind of terrible. I love Mrs. Weasley, but she loves her children so much, and she's going to distrust you every day forever.
That's true. Yeah, but then who are you going to marry?
Oh, God. I'm going to marry... I'm going to marry Lena Duquesne because she's rich and already... You know, like, I just feel like she just needs someone to be nice to her. And I can do that. And she's a very powerful witch with lots of money.
So you're going to sleep with Bella? How's that going to work out?
No, I'm going to kill Bella. I'm going to have sex with Jenny. Earn Molly Weasley's eternal ire. What about you guys?
Oh, I have to think about
them.
Well, okay, here's the thing. Lena Duquesne, I think I would marry because I feel like her family situation, obviously, while weird, there's also a sense of, like, it's still kind of a family. In terms, like, I know that sounds weird, but they have, like, get-togethers.
Only if you're good,
though. Only if you're a light caster.
It seems like you need to wear a lot of fun outfits.
Yeah, you get fun outfits. Like, I'd be okay with that. And I feel like they'd be very accepting of a lesbian lifestyle, despite the fact that the town would obviously not be.
Well, but the town's already not accepting of them. So.
Right, exactly. So it kind of doesn't matter in that way. But
basically, you got no mother-in-law, and Freaky Macon is dead. It's kind of ideal.
That's true. I did read on the wiki that he comes back in later books.
No, I hate that. Yeah. I hate when dead characters come back.
Yeah, I don't know why or how because I refuse.
Oh my god, I should put in Sansa Stark. Just make it a real yak fest.
Ugh. Hold on. I'm going to change my answer. I'm marrying Ginny Weasley. I'm having sex with Lena Duquesne, killing Bella Swan, because I realize I don't want to have sex with Ginny Weasley, but I really don't want to have sex with Bella Swan.
No.
Never mind.
Her clumsy ass, she's going to, like, gouge an artery having sex with you, right? Ugh. Like, I feel like Bella Swan is always, like, having a sudden cut, and then there are vampires. Like, that's her life.
I'd say I'd kill her to put her out of my misery, and then I'll just marry Ginny Weasley, because I think I could take Molly Weasley as a mother-in-law. I think I could take her.
Yeah.
Not take her, like, in a fight, but definitely, like, I'd be okay with it. Plus, at that point, you get to hang out with Ron and Harry and Hermione all the time.
The remaining Weasleys.
Oh, I would comfort Fred. I'd have an affair with, wait, Fred or George? Which one died? Fred died, didn't he? George is the one that lives, so
he's a bummer now, dude. He's like drunk in a bar somewhere. He's like canon literature Han Solo being drunk after Chewbacca died.
Oh no.
That's who you're having sex with, dude.
Whatever, still a Weasley.
Are you going to deviate from the standard?
Because there's Percy, too, you know.
I like,
gross.
Wait a second, you know,
he
no one's,
count.
No one's, Bill is, not Bill, what's the other one? The Bruiser
Charlie.
Weasley. Charlie is the underrated Weasley. He hangs out with dragons all the time. He's kind of a rugby babe. I'm into him.
I'm into him, too. He's just always away in Romania. And let's be honest, I would just have sex with a lot of the men in the Weasley family.
Gross. Ugh, gingers.
Yikes. I love gingers.
Nissa, are you going to deviate from our... What are you going to do? Are you going to marry Bella Swan just to be contrary?
Absolutely not. I cannot. But my kill option, I only get one, and this is terrible.
You can't kill them all.
I could kill them all in different ways.
No.
Oh.
You can't. I'm sorry, no.
Oh, I don't want to marry any of them.
You have to.
Nissa, you have to marry them, and you have to marry them now.
Oh.
Tell me.
You know, I probably wouldn't marry any of the Weasleys because, like, they wouldn't care if I went away after a while. Just, like, run out on Ginny, and then they could comfort her because I can't take Ginny for a long time either. And that leaves sleeping with Lena Duquesne because there really is no chance that I'm going to do anything except kill Bella Swan.
I know this sounds weird. I thought about having sex with Bella Swan only because I thought perhaps it would, if she had some experience outside of Edward Cullen, it might break whatever spell he has fucking cast on her.
No, dude.
She'd just talk about him all the time, wouldn't she?
She'd be crying while you were eating her pussy. She'd be like, Edward loves me. That's what sex with Bella Swan is like forever.
She'd call you Edward.
Yeah. She'd close her eyes and think of Edward.
He'd probably be watching from the window, too.
Creep. Okay, dude. I said we were going to do a good MFK to you, but I lied to you to make you get through that. So we're gonna
that's fine.
Close up shop, and I will leave you with the hope of another MFK next episode. But in the meantime, stay cool, babes, and best of luck getting out of the jungle of death. Bye.
Bye.
Bye.